War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. War made the U.S. independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Welcome to Key Battles of American History, a podcast in which we discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. Here is your host, James Early.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Pacific War on Film. This is your host, James Early, as always. And also, as always, as usual, as always, I have my good buddy, Sean McIver, here with me. Sean, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing good.
Very good. All right. Well, we are going to be looking at a film that is sort of about the Battle of Okinawa, but actually it's really more about the life and war service of Medal of Honor winner Desmond Doss. And the movie, if you haven't already figured it out by now, it's a fairly recent movie. It came out in 2016 and it's called Hacksaw Ridge. It is in length 2 hours and 19 minutes. It got very good reviews in general. Rotten Tomatoes, it got an average positive rating from 84% of the critics and 91% of the fans. On IMDb, it got an average rating of 8.1 out of 10. And again, we talked about this before. If you get over 8, that's really good. It's IMDb is pretty tough. The director is another legend of the screen, both a legendary actor as well as a legendary director, and that is Mel Gibson. Also very controversial for a variety of reasons, but maybe we won't go into that now, maybe later if Sean feels like it. But The cast is an interesting cast. It stars Andrew Garfield, Sam Worthington, Luke Bracey, Teresa Palmer, Hugo Weaving, Elrond, also Rachel Griffiths, and that great legend of the screen, Vince Vaughn. And the funny thing about this cast is that nearly all of the leading actors, in fact, if you go down the list of actors, even like the 20 highest, I actually put together a chart. Almost all of them are Australian.
Yeah.
There's only three exceptions. Andrew Garfield is British. Hugo Weaving is British. And of course, Vince Vaughn is American, but all the rest of them are Australian.
Well, so is Mel Gibson, actually. Well, I mean, he wasn't born in Australia, but he was raised there. So
American Australian. So they all got some good American accent practice. I'm here to tell you, I don't find fault with any of their accents. I would not have known. I was shocked when I started looking up these people.
Well, Mel Gibson's son Milo's in it, and he was born in America and raised in America. So
true, yeah. But he's way down the list.
An inside job though on the casting, though, I would think.
Yeah, I think he's in it for what, maybe a couple of minutes. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. But almost everybody is Australian. Hugo Weaving and Teresa Palmer, Rachel Griffiths, Sam Worthington. Sam Worthington was born in Britain, but he was raised in Australia also. So,
yeah.
And of course, Worthington's Mr. Avatar. So,
oh, yeah. So what is the film based on? It is actually based on another film. I think that's the first time we've had that happen in our series. It's based on the 2004 documentary film called The Conscientious Objector, which, of course, is also about the life of Desmond Doss. Awards. Hacksaw Ridge was nominated for 6 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. We haven't had a Best Picture win in a while, have we?
Not in a while.
We've had one or two, I think, so far, but not lately. But anyway, also Best Director for Mel Gibson, Best Actor for Andrew Garfield. And he really was good. I'm going to go ahead and tip my hand a little here. I really thought he was great. But anyway, more on that later. Best Film Editing, and it did win that one for Best Film Editing. Best Sound Mixing, another win, and Best Sound Editing. And it received a very large number of other nominations, and it won several other awards, especially at the Australian Academy of Cinema and Television Arts Awards. The Aussies loved it. It really cleaned up at that awards program. So this is not some, second-rate film. This one is highly, highly regarded. Okay, Sean, what do you have to tell us?
Yeah, so this film was Mel Gibson's first film that he directed. since 2006's Apocalypto, and that was 10 years, and it had been about 10 years since, and Mel Gibson had done a previous film before Apocalypto, Passion of the Christ, and then before that, it was 1995, I think, when this last film was directed was Braveheart, where he won the Best Picture. So this film actually was in development for a number of years. It actually had been tried over the many decades to be made as a film, including by the one and only Audie Murphy, who is the most decorated American combat soldier of World War II. And I think he may be the most decorated American combat soldier ever. He was a Medal of Honor awardee in the European theater and became a Hollywood actor after the war. He tried to make a film about Desmond Doss with producer Hal Wallace and never really came about. In 2001, they finally were able to get a movie going. Bing Crosby's grandson was the screenwriter and producer, and was funded. A film was going to be funded by the Seventh-day Adventist Church, but it ultimately fell apart as well. Then, so The Conscientious Objector was directed by Terry Benedict, a filmmaker and producer, and they did very fairly well for a documentary film. And then, but then he lost the rights to the dramatic film version of it to Walden Media, and which Walden Media, if you don't know, they are a film company, and they do a lot of stuff based on children's literature and biographies. And I think the most famous film they probably did was The Chronicles of Narnia that they produced, which is really, really, really good. Several of those movies. So
did they do all three of them?
They produced all three of them. They were released, two of them released by Disney and one by 20th Century Fox.
Right. Yeah, I love those movies too.
So Walden Media, they've done a lot of films and a lot of historical films and biographies and children's literature, family films. But Mel Gibson was approached a couple of times to do the movie, and he turned them down twice before he finally agreed in 2014. And they cast Andrew Garfield, and they made the film with $40 million, but they ended up having to get a lot of tax incentives, tried to get a lot of tax incentives in Australia, and they ended up having to get some government subsidies from the Australian government. But they filmed a lot of it in Australia to qualify those. So, and actually casting all those Australian actors helped get them those government subsidies, because it became a majority Australian production between the casting of a lot of Australian actors and the director being someone who was raised in Australia. So there you go.
Pretty smart. Yeah, that helps explain why there's so many Australians in the movie.
Yeah. And so the film was written by Robert Schnecken in the initial draft, but Randall Wallace had worked with Mel Gibson on Braveheart before, and they won an Oscar for the film, and he was nominated for an Oscar for screenwriting. Randall Wallace actually was at one point approached to direct the film, and he's done a few films that he's directed. He directed We Were Soldiers with Mel Gibson. But he did a pass on the script, and a couple of other folks did indeed contribute to the scripting as well. The film was filmed in 2015. Filming took place entirely in Australia, so between live sets and then studios in a lot of the location, like the nighttime stuff towards the end of the battle on top of the ridge, a lot of that was filmed inside of a soundstage.
Interesting. All right. So, well, you got anything else? I was kind of...
No, I really like Hugo Weaving in this film. I think Hugo Weaving does a fantastic job.
Yes.
As Garfield's father. I think he's great. He's fantastic in this film.
Yeah, he is really terrific. Now, as far as accuracy, well, this movie, it gets the big picture right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. You know, I'm not one of these people that says, okay, well, that medal was wrong, or that hat was wrong, or that shoe was wrong, or something like that, you know, or, you know, this guy, his name in the movie is Fred Smith, but it was really Charles Smith or something. I'm not one of these people that's super hung up on the details and the minutia. And there's some time compression in this, like there are in a lot of movies and based on historical events. And there's also a few things that were added for dramatic effect or just changed. But overall, I think it gets the big story right. And when Sean and I will point out some of the discrepancies. Again, I think they're minor. Do you agree with me, Sean? It's not.
Oh, yeah.
Not like a movie like, I don't know. Let's see. How about
Wind Talkers?
Yeah.
I actually thought there was some accuracy. There was good accuracy in places in Wind Talkers.
I was thinking about Gladiator, you know, where
Gladiator,
like,
yes.
Commodus yeah. kills Marcus Aurelius, which is totally wrong.
Yeah. I think Mel Gibson is a lot more interested in the intersection of faith and conviction and violence. In really all of his major films, he's really interested in that than necessarily the accuracy, gruesome accuracy and historical accuracy of the film. I mean, Apocalypto had problems. Braveheart had a lot of problems. I mean, they mixed and matched a lot of history. Passion of the Christ, I think they've sought to have a lot of accuracy in the depiction, you know, as opposed to a more traditional film like, you know, The Greatest Story Ever Told or something like that. Mm-hmm. But
They didn't even speak English in The Passion of the Christ. They spoke Aramaic and Latin.
They spoke Aramaic and Latin. In Apocalypto, they spoke, whatever they were speaking in. I liked Apocalypto. But again, the history was not quite there. But in this one, I think the history takes a back seat really to this remarkable story of Desmond Doss and the fact that he was willing to die to risk his life to save others' lives. And that's, you know, and that was where his conviction lay. And I think that's the part that really is strong in this film. And Andrew Garfield does a great job of portraying that character, and you get to understand why he is the way he is. So I think we should just get started on the film and really get into it. But I think that's where we really need to go with this.
Yeah, let's do it. It's just a terrific story.
I have quibbles with some of the scenes and some of the performances, but as far as the overall story, I think it's excellent.
All right. Well, here we go. We'll start with the introduction. The movie opens with a combat scene from the Battle of Okinawa. Desmond Doss has been wounded and is being carried to safety, and we hear him quoting from the Book of Isaiah. And then we are taken back in a flashback to rural 1920s Virginia, in which we see the young Desmond Doss. He's just a boy playing with his brother Hal. At a military cemetery, meanwhile, the boy's father, Tom, is drinking and speaking to his dead friends who were killed in World War I. Tom is played by Hugo Weaving, as Sean already mentioned. Hugo Weaving is perhaps most famous for his role in the movie The Matrix, or maybe even more famous for his role as Elrond in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. He was the Red Skull in the first Captain America movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. What else? Hugo Weaving is a great actor. What else has he done, Sean?
Oh, I mean, he's most famous as Mr. Smith in The Matrix and as Elrond.
Right.
I'm trying to think what else I've seen Hugo Weaving in. I mean, he's just one of those characters that, you know, he's really associated with The Matrix more than anything else to me. He did the voice of Megatron in the Transformers movies. Mm-hmm. Great actor. And I don't know. He plays a great bad guy, and he plays a great severe, stern person. But I mean, he is literally iconic as Mr. Anderson, you know.
Well, I remember when I saw for the first time, I went to see The Fellowship of the Ring in the theater in 2001. I had seen The Matrix trilogy, and I saw him speaking in this English accent, and I thought, wow, he does a great British accent. And I realized later, no, he is British. He does a great American accent. In The Matrix, as well as a Southern accent here. Yeah. And Tom is one of these people who his life was shattered by the war. He survived the war, but he was never the same. And that's referred to later on. He's got a ongoing case of PTSD, and he medicates himself with drink. And he's a pitiful or a pathetic character in the literal sense of the word. You know, it's sad, but we'll see what he does later. Desmond, the boy Desmond and his brother Hal are fighting, and Tom just sits back and watches them. Desmond hits Hal with a brick, rendering him unable to hear. And Tom is just about to beat him, but the boy's mother, Bertha, played by Teresa, Rachel Griffith, that's Teresa Palmer is Desmond's wife. Anyway, Rachel Griffith, she stops him. She says, what good is it going to do? And Desmond is shaken by the fact that he could have killed Hal. After Desmond hears his father threatening his mother, he asks her why Tom hates them. Bertha says he doesn't hate them, that he was a different person before the war. And there's also this really great part where after the fight is over and after Desmond has hit Hal with a brick, he sees this poster on the wall. I don't know if a poster is the right word, but it's kind of a montage of different biblical scenes, and there's some quotes from scripture, and one of them has Cain and Abel. And there's the, you know, of course, for those who don't know the story of Cain and Abel, they were two brothers mentioned early in the book of Genesis, and Cain actually kills his brother Abel. And the young Desmond, the boy, realizes he could have killed his brother with that brick. And there's also a quote on there from the Ten Commandments, "Thou shalt not kill." And that makes a big impression on Desmond. And that's a true story. We don't know exactly when that happened, but I've seen an interview with Doss where he mentioned that particular image of Cain and Abel and the quote of "Thou shalt not kill." I should say that Desmond was raised in a very strict religious home, very devout Seventh-day Adventist. So that means that their day of worship was Saturday rather than Sunday. They were pacifists, and they also were vegetarian, when long before being a vegetarian was cool. You know, the Seventh-day Adventists have always stressed good health, good nutrition, and so Desmond grew up not eating meat. And that's going to come back later in the movie as well. So what do you think about this initial part, Sean? Your thoughts?
That's good. Lays a good groundwork for the film. I mean, for the story. It shows you part of the reason why he's chosen the pacifist way. Mm-hmm. Why Desmond has. And you'll see why that becomes important as you go.
Yeah, it's partly his religious upbringing, but also partly that near murder experience, I guess, to make
yeah, and not murder, but he act in anger, so you know he's got a temper, and that's something. What I like about this, the way they lay this film out, is that they don't give you everything about Desmond right at once.
Yeah, yeah, we learn little bits and pieces along the way, which is really neat.
Yeah, and so the good thing is also this is where you're introduced to Andrew Garfield, and Andrew Garfield has this really serene, affable serenity. Like, he's got this kind of goofy smile, but it's not self-satisfied. It's very genuine. Like, you can tell there's a joy in his heart that's coming out. And I really like the way he portrays this character. And he does get frustrated and he gets angry later in the film, but you see the nature of his character. He truly believes what he believes. He truly believes. He truly has faith. Yeah. He truly believes in his convictions, and not in a mean way, but in a joyful way, as this is part, and it's part of what's coming out of him. So I really like his portrayal. It can be kind of goofy sometimes and kind of sappy, but I think he manages to straddle that line really well of keeping it, not letting it get too goofy, you know, too sappy and silly.
Yeah. Garfield, who of course plays the grown-up Desmond, he mm-hmm. portrays him as a rather complex character. You know, as you said, deeply
yeah, he's not an innocent.
Deeply devout. He's not a cartoon character or anything. He's humble and he's submissive to authority, but at the same time, he's has no problem with speaking his mind when he feels something is wrong and speaking up for himself. He's kind of cocky sometimes, you know. He's kind of cocky with the girl that he's going to pursue. We'll talk about that in a minute, but he's fun.
Yeah. And that's the thing is that, but the big thing is that he sees this accident and this man is, he's got his, a bad gash on his leg and he's bleeding out, and he jumps in and saves the man's life with the tourniquet. He doesn't think of himself. He jumps in. And that's, like, you see that as that's the dominant, like, he has an aw-shucks kind of air about him, but at the same time, like, that does not make him a buffoon. It does not make him a fool.
Right.
And I want to kind of harken back to our previous series. We talked about another pacifist about to go to war.
Sergeant Alvin York.
And Gary Cooper plays him first as a wayward sinner who becomes saved and has a life transforming event. But even Alvin York, although Alvin York is much more, you know, and it's a 50, 60 year difference in films and filmmaking, but Gary Cooper's Alvin York still has a lot of wisdom to him. He's got a lot of, there is aw shucks, but there's also a lot of genuineness to the character. And so there's a lot more aw shucks to the Alvin York than there is to Desmond Doss. But there's not a lot of difference between the characters in terms of seriousness and in terms of what's in their character.
Yeah, that's a good comparison, because both men, when they're in danger, when something needs to be done, when someone needs to step in and take action to save a life or something like that, they know what to do. They're not afraid to do it. They do it.
Yeah.
They take action. They're men of action. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and they had, and Alvin York was not a Seventh-day Adventist. He was what we would probably most accurately describe as more of a charismatic, Calvinist Christian. But he took a personal stance on pacifism to, and conscientious objection. He didn't want to go to the war. And that's the difference between the characters, as we'll see, is Alvin York didn't want to go. So I don't want to bury the lead here. So let's keep going.
Yeah.
We'll talk a little bit more about how Desmond and Alvin York compare in the next
couple of scenes. It's a great comparison. So Desmond, he's grown up now in the next scene. He's a devout member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which teaches pacifism, as we mentioned. He's working around the church one day and he hears an accident outside. And this is what Sean was referring to. He runs out. A man has been his leg has been crushed under a car. And Desmond whips off his belt and makes a tourniquet on this injured man and saves his life. He takes him to the hospital and the doctor says, "You've saved the man's life." While he's at the hospital, Desmond meets a nurse, a beautiful nurse named Dorothy Shute, played by Teresa Palmer. Lovely actress. Desmond gives blood to help the injured man. Before long, Desmond and Dorothy begin dating and seeing each other. Doss tells Dorothy of his interest in medical work. Why don't we stop here and talk a little bit about Andrew Garfield, the star of the movie who plays Desmond Doss. I know him as Spider-Man. He was one of the many Spider-Men through the years. But what else? Tell me a little bit more about
that. He had a breakthrough in the Robert Redford film, Lions for Lambs, and a film called Boy A. But I think his biggest role probably before this, besides Spider-Man, was The Social Network. He played the Eduardo Saverin, who was the entrepreneur. It was a friend of Mark Zuckerberg's in the Social Network. He's a friend of Mark Zuckerberg and helped co-found Facebook, and then was pushed out by Zuckerberg and Sean Parker, and ended up winning a massive, massive lawsuit.
I remember that. I saw that movie about 6 months. I saw that about a year ago or so.
Social Network's an outstanding film.
Good movie.
I don't know how accurate it is, because I think it's a little too soon for us to really have a lot of accuracy about Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook. But it's a fascinating, interesting film. So and Garfield plays a person who's Brazilian immigrant, or is. He's a trust fund baby, but he's a Brazilian student at Harvard. And so he has an accent. He has a Brazilian accent. He's really great in that film. He also, in 2016, the same year he did Hacksaw Ridge, I haven't seen it, but I've heard a lot of good things. He was in Martin Scorsese's film Silence about in Japan, in 16th century Japan. So
I've had several people tell me I need to see that, but I haven't.
Yeah, the book is phenomenal. So very interesting story. So he's done some films. He's actually going to be playing this year the Jim Baker in the film The Eyes of Tammy Faye, the televangelist.
Way. That sounds really good.
I saw the trailer. It looks really good. Yeah. So he's kind of a young up and coming star.
All right. Well,
and he was nominated for an Oscar for this film. He's really good.
Yes. He is outstanding. After the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, Desmond's brother Hal joins the Navy, although he's shown wearing an Army uniform. That's a minor mistake, but at the table one day. Tom and Bertha are very unhappy, and Tom says the uniform reminds him of his friend Artie, who was horribly wounded in World War I. And he, at the dinner table, talks about some of the horrible details of that, and Hal gets up and leaves. And then Desmond enlists in the Army to serve as a combat medic. His father, Tom, who we already talked about, Hugo Weaving, a World War veteran, is deeply upset by the decision. Before Desmond leaves for Fort Jackson, he asks for Dorothy's hand in marriage, and she accepts. After Desmond gets on the train, Dorothy gives him her personal Bible with a photo of her inside. And there's another minor mistake, or I don't know if it's a mistake. I'm sure they knew the truth. They just changed it. But she was actually not a nurse when they first met. She didn't become a nurse until after the war. But again, it's no big deal. That's just one of those things. Yeah, it doesn't matter. That was a good way for them to have a cute way that they met, right? They met because she was in the hospital and he went to the hospital and she just happened to be there. But anyway, no biggie on that. We'll give him a pass on that. We'll give Mel Gibson a pass. I'm sure he really cares what we think about it.
Yeah. Anyway. I have a question though. So I'm assuming while is Desmond specifically devoutly Seventh-day Adventist and his family is not as much? Or is it Desmond and his mother?
I think they all are, except I think his father is so deeply
backslidden. Yeah, they
would say in the church he's backslidden.
Right, but they're not supposed to drink. The First World War, so.
Yeah, maybe he's just not as devout. I mean, oftentimes in a family, the father may not be very religious, but the mother is, and the kids are raised that way.
Right, and Tom, I mean, Hal joins the Navy, so he's certainly not adhering to the, and I'm wondering, was it that the whole Seventh-day Adventist Church as a whole preached pacifism, or was it just certain segments of the church believed in pacifism?
I am not an expert on the Seventh-day Adventist Church, much less their history. I know a little bit, but I think the official doctrine is pacifism. But
it's just interesting because Tom's objections are not religious. They are based on his own experience, and he's jaded and cynical about.
Yeah, he doesn't want his boys to go get killed. He doesn't start quoting scripture or say, this is against the Lord's will. He nothing like that. Yeah, it's purely he's trying to protect his boys from going through the hell that he went through.
Right, and Bertha's objections are more, I'm a mother and I don't want my children. And Bertha, I think. Rachel Griffiths is really great. Rachel Griffiths is a really great actress. She's been in a ton of things. Probably most American audiences remember her from My Best Friend's Wedding with Julia Roberts, 25 years ago.
The 2003 movie The Rookie with Dennis Quaid.
Yes, she was the wife in The Rookie. She was also in 6 Feet Under on HBO for several years, and she got a Golden Globe for that. So I think that's what most people really remember her for. But I think she's really good in this film. So, I was just curious about that because, it doesn't seem like Hal's very concerned about it. And Tom is definitely not, he's a drinker and he was a World War I veteran. So, the thing is that it was very difficult in the second, it was very difficult in the First World War, but it was very difficult in the Second World War for people to be not to not want to serve, to resist that pull to join up, right? Because I remember in watching documentaries and the conversations that oral histories and stuff that the veterans had, especially that Stephen Ambrose recorded for the National World War II Museum before he passed away, or for the Band of Brothers. And I remember one of the members of Easy Company from Band of Brothers, the actual members said, it was very difficult. There was two men in his hometown that killed themselves because they were 4F, so they couldn't go. And so, I think I don't think we have the frame of reference to really understand how it was definitely it would be very difficult to say, I'm not going to serve. I don't know that in America they had women walking up to you with a white feather and handing it to you and shaming you into not going. I think there was a desire among the American population and the young men in the country to serve their country. And I think that's definitely what Desmond talks to Dorothy about, that he wants to serve. He wants to serve his country. He doesn't have to. He mentions he has a deferment.
Yeah, he works in a steel mill, which was considered a critical position.
Yeah, an essential job. He didn't have to go, but he chose to because he's choosing to go for a different reason.
Yeah, he specifically wants to be a medic, and he's convinced that he's going to be able to not be forced to carry a weapon. That's the thing, is he won't even touch a weapon.
Yeah.
Not that it's not that, okay, I'll learn how to use it, but then I just won't use it or something like that. No, he won't even touch it. And that's going to cause some problems, as we will see. All right, let's move on. So part two deals with his training, boot camp at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And I love boot camp sequences in movies, Sean. I'm just a sucker for them. This kind of reminds me of a little bit of a Full Metal Jacket in a way, but not as dark.
Intentionally so. Yeah, that sequence where Vince Vaughn walks into the room is definitely intended to make you think of that.
He's no R. Lee Ermey, but he does the best.
We'll talk about him.
Okay. Desmond arrives at the recruits' barracks at Fort Jackson. There he meets a colorful group of recruits, including, in particular, one guy named Smitty Riker. He is played by the Australian actor Luke Bracer. And this is a kind of a rough guy, not very nice, and he takes an immediate disliking to Desmond. Desmond is placed under the command of Sergeant Howell, played by Vince Vaughn. More on him in a little bit. Who is going to train them? Desmond excels physically, but he becomes an outcast among his fellow soldiers for refusing to handle a rifle or train on Saturdays. He specifically asks for a pass so that he can go to the nearest Seventh-day Adventist church on Saturdays, and that is not popular with the rest of the men, although he does work on Sunday while they're off. But Sergeant Howell and the company commander, Captain Glover, played by Sam Worthington, attempt to discharge Desmond for psychiatric reasons. They say he's crazy. But they're overruled as an Army psychiatrist finds that Desmond's religious beliefs do not constitute mental illness. Smitty and the other men in the company accuse Desmond of cowardice, and they subsequently torment Desmond by putting him through grueling labor, intending to get Desmond to leave of his own accord. One night, he is beaten up by his fellow recruits, but Desmond refuses to identify his attackers, and he uses humor. He's really funny. What is it? He says... you know, the sergeant says to him, well, who did this? Who beat you up? And he said, I didn't say anybody beat me up. And the sergeant said, well, how'd you get all bruised and bloody? And he says, I sleep really rough. It's really funny. That's a great part. Anyway, so Desmond continues his training. He refuses to be drummed out of the service, and he refuses to quit. The other recruits are impressed by this. All right, Sean, what do you have to say about this?
Yeah, so Vince Vaughn, okay.
Why? Why?
He does have some funny lines. There's the when he's going through, and it's very reminiscent of Full Metal Jacket. He's the one good looking guy. Everybody has a nickname. He gives everybody a nickname. And like the good looking guy, he's called Hollywood. Him Hollywood. Have you ever roped a goat, Hollywood? No, Sarge. Have you ever looked into a goat's eyes? No, Sarge. Good. That would be unnatural. And then he tells Desmond, you look. I've seen stalks of corn with better physiques, makes me want to pull an ear off. And he says, tells the corporal to make sure you keep this man away from strong winds. Yeah. I mean, that's very funny.
Private corn stalk.
Right. But he's not menacing. And the thing is that Full Metal Jacket, the scene in Full Metal Jacket with R. Lee Ermey, when he comes in and he's saying these things and you're cracking up and everybody's cracking up. And then he chokes out the guy. And all of a sudden it turns on a dime. And that's Stanley Kubrick as a director, knowing how to change the mood of a scene immediately. I see Vince Vaughn and I see Swingers and I see Dodgeball and I see Old School and I see whatever movies that he was in. I see him in Anchorman. I see him in all these comedies. I see him in The Breakup. I see him in comedies. And I've seen him do dramatic work. He was really, really good in a film called Into the Wild. And he has a small part, but he's really, really does well. I don't think he carries off. And he's very stiff and like, he's not like fluid in his movements. And that's the other thing that I don't buy him as a drill sergeant. I just don't. I'm sorry. I mean, they may have films that he's done that are action films or whatever, but I don't think Gibson directs him very well. And I don't think it's the right casting. I, as a matter of fact, I would have flipped the casting. I would have had him be the captain and Sam Worthington be the sergeant.
Well, interestingly enough, Sean, I read on IMDb that Mel Gibson was originally going to play the sergeant himself.
Yeah.
He was going to be Sergeant Howell, but then he decided to not actually act in the movie so he could focus 100% on directing.
I think that was a smart move in a way, and it's because... at this point, I don't think people want to see Mel Gibson act in movies. I just don't think they do anymore. I think that he is a very talented director, much like Kevin Costner is. But he's got a lot of baggage that Kevin Costner does not have. he has a lot of baggage in terms of his public persona and the things that he said and done over the past couple of years. And I think that would detract from things. And I think that being behind the camera gives him a degree of there's eccentricities and dislike that you can have for a filmmaker and still watch their films to a certain extent. I think people have hit that point with Woody Allen, but even behind the camera, I think people hit that point with Roman Polanski behind the camera. But you can be a weirdo, you can be a jerk, and as a director, you can still be hailed as a genius or held, you know, be considered a, you know, looked at the product on the screen and be appreciated for the product on the screen. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that even as a supporting character, people want to see Mel Gibson very much. So,
yeah, he would have been too old anyway for the role, I think.
I don't know. There was plenty of drill sergeants that were in their 40s. Yeah, he would have been in. Let's see, he's 65 now. So that was what?
5 years ago.
It was 2016. Yeah, it was 6 years. It was 7 years ago. No, 5 years. Yeah, he's 60. It's pushing it a little bit. He could have been a general.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's keep going. Desmond completes the whole unit. They complete their basic training. Desmond is released on leave, or at least he's supposed to be. He's scheduled to be released. The whole unit goes on leave. But, and Desmond, by the way, is intending to marry Dorothy during this time, although he'd already married her, but that's okay. His refusal to carry a firearm leads to an arrest for insubordination. And as a result of his arrest, Desmond fails to make it to his own wedding. Knowing Desmond would not back out on his promise to marry him, Dorothy realizes something is wrong. Captain Glover and Dorothy both visit Desmond in jail and try to convince him to plead guilty so that he can be released without charge. But Desmond refuses to compromise his beliefs. Dorothy accuses Desmond of pride, but she nevertheless assures him of her love and support no matter what happens. While sleeping, Desmond is reminded of a time that he had to physically prevent his father from hurting his mother. Now, first of all, Desmond was never actually court-martialed, although they did try to, he definitely tried to get him to quit many, many times. Mm-hmm. Second, this thing about his father hurting his mother, it was actually his father threatening his brother-in-law, his mother's brother, and Desmond did intervene and prevent Tom, his father, from shooting Tom's brother-in-law, Desmond's uncle. But anyway, again, minor details.
Dramatic life.
So we have a court-martial scene, and it looks like it's pretty hopeless for Desmond, but Desmond decides at the last minute to change his plea from guilty to not guilty, shocking his own defense attorney. And then Tom, wearing his old World War I uniform, goes to see a general who was his company commander during the war. And let's see. Desmond's at the trial says he did obey his commanding officer, but he wants to serve as a medic, but he can't bear arms. Before he is sentenced, in a very dramatic scene, his father barges into the tribunal with a letter from the general stating that his son's pacifism is protected by an act of Congress. The officer presiding at the court-martial reads the letter, and then he decides to drop the charges against Desmond, and the case is dismissed. And soon after, Desmond and Dorothy are married. And again, this did not happen. Desmond's father, Tom, did not barge into the courtroom and present a letter from a general. None of that happened, but it's good.
Yeah, what act of Congress was he referring to is the other question I had.
I do not know. I've seen this movie like 5 times, but I did not memorize it. According to the true story, when Desmond was denied leave for refusing to touch a gun, his father contacted the chairman of the Church's War Service Commission in Washington, Carlisle B. Haynes. The chairman made a call to the regimental commander, Colonel Stephen Hamilton, asking if it was necessary for him to come investigate the situation with Desmond Doss. The colonel told him no, and that they would straighten things out. Desmond still had to wait for his furlough, but as a result of his father's actions, he was given a 3-day pass to go home and see his brother Harold before he returned to the Navy to go overseas. So that's from the website History Versus Hollywood. So so the real life story was not quite as exciting and dramatic as what happened in the movie, but it's great film. It's great drama, don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they originally, the colonel who's presiding at the trial, you know, at first tells Tom, you got to get out of here. You're not in the military anymore. And Tom says something like, was that how it is? Do we use our soldiers and then just write them off and cast them aside? And the colonel says, all right, give me the letter. it's fun. But it's not the truth, but that's okay. Any thoughts on that, Sean, besides what I already said?
No, I mean, this is a Hollywood scene.
Yeah. Now, the next thing.
Before we move on, we want to make a few comparisons with Sergeant Alvin York.
Yes.
He was willing to pick up a gun. He just wasn't willing to use it to kill. But they actually initially in the training, if we remember, they did try to discourage him, and they told the officers, or they told the sergeants, to keep an eye out on him. He's going to be a troublemaker. And he turned out to be a model soldier. And just like Desmond does, he turns out to be a model soldier. It's just the difference between Alvin and Desmond. And they actually think the funny thing on the Sergeant York film is, so if you haven't seen it, go and watch Sergeant York. It's a really good film. But they ask him, Mr. Pacifist, what do you even know what a gun is? And he's like, oh, I never had a gun like this. He's a crack shot, you know. So they can't believe how good a shot he is. So the difference between Alvin and Desmond is Desmond's not willing to take a lot to even pick up a gun. He's willing to save lives. And in Alvin York, the reason why he received the Medal of Honor and the decision that he made ultimately to fight was to save the lives of Americans, to save the lives of his men, his own men that he was with.
He just uses a very different method to save lives.
To stop the fighting by winning. Whereas Desmond's position is he's going to save lives, and that's it. He's going to help people. He's going to heal, not hurt. So
yeah, without taking any lives. Yeah.
Yes. All right, let's get going.
That's good. All right, so now we're going to Hacksaw Ridge. Go ahead.
Right.
James here. And now a brief word from our sponsors.
So tell us the date of where we're starting now, and then let's pause. I want to talk about something.
Yeah, and I may beat you to the punch, but okay. We'll see. In May of 1945 is where we're going to go all the way to Okinawa, and it's not even the beginning of the battle. The battle's already been going on for a good month or so. Now, this is more time compression. Desmond and his unit had already, by this time, fought in the battle for Guam when the U.S. invaded and retook it, and also in Leyte, one of the larger Philippine islands. I've talked about that in my battle series very briefly, both of those. So by the time Desmond and his unit got to Okinawa, they were already seasoned combat veterans, and Desmond had already saved a lot of lives and helped a lot of people, but...
He won two Bronze Stars already.
Yeah, yeah. So he was already a proven hero, but for the sake of dramatic license and just to compress it.
Yeah.
I guess Gibson didn't want to do what they did in Midway. Of course, Midway hadn't come out yet, but my point is that he didn't want to have, 2 minutes on this battle, 5 minutes on this battle, 10 minutes on this battle. He wanted to give more time to what actually happened on Okinawa.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Is that what you were going to say?
Yeah, I think that. Yeah, and the thing is that in the course of the Battle of Okinawa, Doss becomes closer to his the men in his company, right? And they actually, he the antagonism that they had in training is still carried over even into the first scenes in Okinawa, but then as they go, it drops away. And so I think that you could have had them coming to Okinawa, and now Desmond's a grizzled veteran. Combat veteran, but you lose that. Yeah, I understand why they make this choice, but from a historical perspective, like they're already combat veterans when they step foot on Okinawa. This is not their combat debut,
Yeah.
Unlike when we watched Windtalkers, and even when last time when we watched the time before when we watched the Flags of Our Fathers, some of the soldiers, it was their first time in battle. Some of them were veterans. Like this one, I'm sure that was the case, but the main characters, or at least Desmond and the sergeant and the captain, they'd all been in combat. So two different, battles. Guam was pretty heated and Leyte was a pretty fierce battle. So,
yeah. And it's not like Mel Gibson says, oh, they didn't fight in any other battles. It's not like Gibson just tells you, okay, this is their first battle, but you kind of get that impression because the guys are kind of wide-eyed, and there's a scene where Desmond has got his medic's armband on and a helmet with the cross and another grizzled veteran medic. So you need to take those off because the Japanese are going to shoot you. And
yeah,
he would have already gotten rid of them long before that.
Yeah.
But anyway, all right, with that in mind, let's go ahead. In May 1945, Desmond's unit is assigned to the 77th Infantry Division and deployed to Okinawa. As soon as they arrive, they are passed by a convoy of trucks, one of which carries several dead soldiers. And again, there's that, the guys are kind of wide-eyed. Oh my gosh, that's kind of a war movie trope, you know, where the new guys come in and they see a bunch of dead bodies. I mean, we saw that way back in All Quiet on the Western Front, you know, remember that from 1930? Mm-hmm. That's a common trope in war movies. But again, they wouldn't have been quite so surprised to see all these dead bodies. But anyway, Desmond's unit is informed that they are to relieve the 96th Infantry Division, which was tasked with ascending and securing the Maida Escarpment. That's the official name, but the nickname is Hacksaw Ridge, which is a big high, well, it's a elevated area. There's a big cliff that you have to climb up to get to it. It's amazing to look at. Part of the 96th is put under Captain Glover's command, Sam Worthington's character. Two medics from the 96th introduce themselves to Doss, and one of them is named Herb Schechter. I'm sorry, it's Herb, and he was a real person. Schechter tells Doss to get rid of his medic insignia because the Japanese deliberately target medics. Okay, so I kind of already mentioned that, but anyway, that's just Gibson's way of, and the scriptwriter's way of telling you that happened, and it really did happen. We saw that in from the Japanese perspective in our last movie, Letters from Iwo Jima. Now, prior to the 77th assault on Hacksaw Ridge, the Navy bombards it. And of course, there's another trope, and this was true with a lot of new guys, you know, the idea that there nothing could survive that, you know, that there can't be anybody alive up there after all that naval gunpowder. And one of the characters actually says, oh yeah, they can survive that. The men begin the long climb up the rope ladder. It's a cargo net, the same kind they use to ascend and descend ships. And it takes them to the top of the ridge. And after the men reach the top, they advance, stepping over many dead Americans and Japanese. The hidden Japanese defenders open fire, and the Americans suffer heavy losses. And the situation is similar to what we've seen in several of the other movies. The Japanese are dug in. They've got very strong pillboxes. They occasionally do a bonsai charge, which surprises and kind of freaks out the Americans. And as the Americans advance, they kill many Japanese. Desmond saves his squad mate, Smitty. Now, this is the guy that couldn't stand Desmond, was always picking on him. And so he earns his respect. When a Japanese soldier grabs Desmond, Sergeant Howell shoots the soldier. During the battle, Desmond helps several other wounded soldiers. By the end of the day, the Americans have wiped out a strong Japanese position near the edge of the cliff. Desmond continues to look for and to treat wounded soldiers throughout the night. As the Americans camp for the night, Desmond reveals to Smitty that his aversion to holding a firearm stems from nearly shooting his drunken father, who threatened his mother with a gun. And again, that really happened, except he was threatening his mother's brother, Tom's brother-in-law. Smitty apologizes for doubting his courage, and the two reconcile. Also, I should say, too, the vegetarianism comes in because Desmond, I don't know, Smitty says something about the food, and Desmond says, I don't eat meat. And that's true. I was the real Desmond actually was hungry a lot during the campaigns because the sea rations had a lot of meat in them, and he wouldn't eat the meat. He would just eat the cracker and mm-hmm. whatever else he could get his hand on that wasn't meat. So that's kind of like the day one of the battle for the, and this of course is not the, as I already hinted and indicated, this is not the first attack on this escarpment. It's just the first one that Desmond's unit was involved in. So what do you think about this part? Good fighting scenes, huh?
Yeah. I can't remember if they used a satchel charge, but
they did. They did.
Well, there you go. My bingo card is already filling up.
Okay, you got the wide-eyed soldiers when the
wide-eyed soldier training.
You got
the stereotypical squad mates.
Oh yeah, you got a guy from Jersey or something, and you got a
good-looking guy. Desmond is
the southerner, the hillbilly.
Yeah, you got a good-looking guy.
Nothing couldn't be alive up there with all that naval power.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
What else? What were your other thoughts about it?
No, that's about it. Yeah, that's a good scene. Interesting. There was a good battleship scene where they're firing, and I think it was CGI battleship. It wasn't stock footage, so I thought that was interesting.
Did we have the Texas in this one?
These were the three turret battleships that were later, the Alabama class, South Dakota class, or the North Carolina class, or the New Jersey class, or Iowa class battleships. So
the Texas was too wimpy to have participated in this.
No, I mean, the Texas was there. Actually, I believe this was where the Texas got hit by a kamikaze off of Okinawa.
Mm.
It's either Okinawa or Iwo Jima, but all the battleships were at Okinawa.
There were hundreds of American ships. It was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah,
it was the greatest naval bombardment ever in history, as far as I know. I don't know of a greater one.
Yeah. Now, so this was a month into the fight. Was your dad still on the island at that time, or had he already cycled out?
Sean, I wish I could tell you. I have no idea exactly what Dad did at Okinawa. I'm still working on that. I've got down what he did at Guadalcanal and Tarawa, but I'm still working on Iwo Jima and Okinawa.
Well, because the Marines went in and were part of the Marines and the Army invaded Okinawa on the initial wave, right?
Yeah,
but then subsequent units that came in were Army units.
Yes.
As they went. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess
I'm sure you talked about it in your battle series, but Okinawa was in many ways the toughest nut to crack of all of them.
Oh yeah,
even compared to Iwo Jima.
Maybe absolutely. The terrain was just wicked, just ridges and ravines and gullies and you name it. And then, not to mention, it rained nonstop for days and days and days and days, and it was just a big mud pit.
Right, and then of course, I think Okinawa probably is most famous for. It's really the height of the kamikaze attacks on the naval, the Allied naval fleet, because it was actually truly an Allied fleet. It was American ships, Australian ships, and the British Far Eastern fleet, a large task force, actually participated. All the British heavy carriers were there as well, and almost all of the American carriers. There were several carriers that were knocked out. No carriers were sunk, but several carriers were knocked out of action for the rest of the war. The Enterprise was put out of action for the rest of the war at Okinawa. So, and I think also the last week of the battle, the highest ranking American commander was killed in combat.
Lieutenant General Simon Bolivar Buckner Jr.
Yeah.
Son of a Confederate general who had surrendered to Grant, Fort Donelson.
the son of a Confederate general.
Even though that was what, like 80 years prior, than 80 years. I think his dad was a spry old man, shall we say.
I think he was actually older than, MacArthur or around the same age as MacArthur?
Pretty close.
MacArthur's dad was a Civil War veteran too.
Yeah, but I mean, MacArthur's dad was just a captain or something. I don't know. He may have worked his way up through the ranks, but Arthur MacArthur was very young during the Civil War, but Simon Bolivar Buckner was older.
Yeah.
He wasn't real old or anything, but he was probably 30, 40s. He was the same age as Grant, I think.
Right. Okinawa was one of the bloodiest battles of the war. I think it was the highest casualty rate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
For the Americans, the highest killed. Death, not just proportion of casualties, but definitely the highest killed battle. Iwo Jima was one of the few battles where the Americans had more casualties than the Japanese. But I mean, this one was just a meat grinder in Okinawa on both sides. And it was part of it was truly part of Japan's home islands. It was the doorstep of Japan.
Oh, yeah.
So they fought very fiercely. So it was a bloody, nasty battle.
Yeah. All right, well, so back to the movie. They spent the night. Now we go to the second day. The next morning, the Japanese launch a massive counterattack, and they drive the Americans back. Captain Glover calls in an artillery strike on the attackers, and they're trying to get the heck out of there. Smitty is hit, and he dies despite Doss's effort to help him. The Americans, who were able to go back down the rope ladder off the ridge, well, I didn't say that very well. The Americans who are able to, they go back down the cargo net and they get off the ridge, but many are wounded and cannot do that. And Desmond stays with them, even though he's fine at this point. He hasn't been hurt. And Sergeant Howell and several of Doss's squad mates are left injured on the battlefield. Desmond hears the cries of dying soldiers and he returns to save them, carrying the wounded to the cliff's edge and lowering them down on the rope. He ties this type of knot, which is able to slip under their arms, and he lowers them down. This is the climax of the movie. This is the best part, in my opinion. I love this part. And Captain Glover, he's escaped. He's down on the ground, and he tells the colonel in command to call off the planned artillery attack because there's still about 100 Americans at the top of the ridge. The arrival of dozens of wounded, once presumed dead, comes off as a shock to the rest of the unit below. It's really amazing when Desmond lowers the first guy down on the rope, and the people think it's a Japanese, and they're about to shoot him, and then they realize, wait a minute, this is an American. And then they just keep coming, just one at a time, all during the night.
He's just exhausted every time he brings someone back, and he says, just one more.
He's
almost a prayer. He's praying
to God, Lord, let me do this one more.
Right.
And one more turns into five, and then 10, and then 20, and before long, well, we'll get to that later. At the top of the ridge, a Japanese patrol arrives and begins killing off the wounded Americans that they find. Sergeant Howell calls on him for help. This is a very dramatic scene. The Japanese are closing in. Desmond covers Howell completely with dirt. And he says, you got to trust me. And he basically buries him. He's already kind of partly buried, but he covers him up. Desmond lies under a dead man. Japanese soldier bayonets the dead body, but Desmond is unhurt. The Japanese finally leave, and Desmond drags Sergeant Howell to safety. And Desmond dodges Japanese fire and eventually escapes into an underground cave, evading a grenade that is tossed after him. Japanese soldiers march by. This is a really exciting, suspenseful part. Desmond avoids being seen and even places a bandage on a wounded Japanese soldier and gives him morphine. And I did some research on this. There's actually no evidence. There's no definite corroboration that Desmond ever aided a Japanese soldier, although I read that there was one Japanese soldier who was later found with an American bandage on him. So maybe he did. Who knows? They even mention in the movie that Desmond lowered down a couple of Japanese soldiers to be healed, but that may or may not have happened. Probably didn't. But anyway, during the night, Desmond keeps lowering wounded men down. And again, as we said, he's praying every time to save one more. By the morning, he's lowered several dozen. And then when day breaks, Desmond discovers Sergeant Howell and another soldier, Hollywood. This is a guy we mentioned earlier. And it's kind of funny. He, in the beginning of the movie, when we first see the training camp, he's actually like exercising in the nude. And it's kind of funny because Sergeant Howell makes him run out and do all the like obstacle course and everything, butt naked. But here he's not nude, but he is wounded. So Hollywood and Sergeant Howell are hiding from the Japanese. Desmond lowers Hollywood to safety. Then he goes back to the sergeant, and at the field hospital, Hollywood tells the captain that it's Doss. You know, it's pretty much just Doss who's responsible for lowering all these wounded to safety. And then with a Japanese sniper shooting at him, Desmond puts Howell on a blanket. He drags Howell to the edge of the ridge while Howell fires at the pursuing Japanese. This is kind of a, what do you think about this part, Sean? It's kind of a Hollywood-esque, like Desmond.
Yes, very much.
He's on a blanket. The sergeant is lying on a blanket facing the rear, and he's got his, I think it's an M3, one of those grease rifles, or what do they call those? I don't know.
Yeah,
M3. It looks like a grease gun. It's an M3 automatic, and he's firing at the Japanese like while he's lying down, and Desmond is pulling him. I imagine, I don't know that really happened. That seems too good to be true, but you never know. This whole story seems too good to be true. Anyway, Desmond finally lowers Howell over the edge while the remaining Japanese fire at him. And that is true. He was being constantly fired at, and they never could hit him. Finally, Desmond, carrying one more soldier, he himself comes down over the edge. He lowers himself down, and that's an amazing scene. It's just great. There's this dramatic pause, and then all of a sudden, boom, here comes Desmond with one other guy. Japanese soldiers appear at the top of the ridge, but the Americans on the ground fire at them, killing them. And then Desmond is carried to the hospital. Okay, so I know the thing where he's dragging the sergeant is maybe too Hollywood, but I just love this scene. This is so great. Don't you?
Well, and actually, he's the soldier that he's carrying is Smitty. It's his body, and he's dead.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, and he jumps off. He jumps off holding onto the body so that basically when the rope tightens, when he hits the bottom of the rope, it'll break Smitty's back, but it won't hurt Desmond. Desmond won't. Because if he jumped off with the rope,
it'd
break his back or his hip or something. So he promised Smitty he'd take him back. He wouldn't leave him when Smitty was dying. So he carries him, and that's what he uses to kind of break his fall as he's going down. Mm. And yeah, the Americans just. Yeah, they unload. There's a bunch of American troops by this point because the stories have been circulating. Because that's the crazy thing is that earlier there's like, where are all these in the hospital in the MASH unit? They're like, where are all these wounded coming from? They're coming from the ridge. Someone's lowering them down on the ridge.
And right.
That's what Hollywood says. It's Desmond. He's the one that's doing it because they think he's up there. They think he's dead up there. And then so more and more American troops are showing up there, and they're getting ready to go up to get Desmond. And that's a great scene when Desmond jumps. I mean, it's a very Hollywood scene, but it's still great. It's a great action scene when Desmond jumps off the ridge, and the American troops, the Japanese troops show up to shoot at him, and they walk into a wall of fire of their own from the ground. Right.
Yeah, there's like 20 guys at the bottom by that point. Yeah. They're all armed to the teeth. Yeah. Oh, that's just such a great scene. I just almost brings tears to your eyes.
And he's not wounded. Well, I mean, I think he's been grazed a couple of times, but
he's
okay, exhausted. He's been awake for, you know, 48 hours or so.
James here. And now a brief word from our sponsors.
All right. Yes. Good stuff. I get excited just talking about it. I love that scene. But yeah, I'm glad you pointed out with Smitty. It's hard to see who it is, you know, because he's way up there and they take the shot from the ground. But I'm sure it was stuntman or something anyway. All right. So we move to the final part. I call this part victory. Now, remember at this point that the Japanese still control the ridge or the escarpment. They're still in control. The Americans had to bug out. They had to retreat. And what Desmond was doing was just lowering down wounded men. They still got to go back up there and capture it. But Captain Glover tells Desmond, and Captain Glover is another guy that was very much not pro Desmond. He did not like Desmond. He repeatedly tried to shame Desmond into actually fighting and was partly responsible for his court martial, which didn't actually happen. But the real Captain Glover really did try to get Desmond to quit. But now he's totally on Desmond's side. He tells him that the men have been inspired by his selflessness, and he asks for Desmond's forgiveness. He then says that the unit has to go back up the ridge the next day. And it's the Sabbath. It's Saturday, and it is Desmond's, obviously, holy day. And he says, but will you please go up anyway? And he says, we're not going to launch the attack without you. And Desmond agrees to go if he can at least begin the day with reading the Bible and praying. So the next day, this is a funny scene. They're all just standing there. They show the entire company and whoever else, the regiment. I don't know what size unit it is. It's a lot of guys. And then they're just standing there, and the colonel radios Captain Glover and says, this attack was supposed to happen 10 minutes ago. What are you waiting on? He says, sir, we can't go until Desmond finishes praying. Desmond Doss. And he's like, who's Desmond Doss? But anyway, they do. They really do wait. And that really did happen. That is a true story. They let Desmond finish his prayer. And then they went up the cargo net again and attacked yet again. And now they have reinforcements and they turn the tide of the battle. After an ambush set by Japanese soldiers feigning surrender, you know, that was a common tactic throughout the war when a Japanese would pretend to surrender. And then as the Americans would approach, boom, they whip out a grenade or something like that. And that's exactly what happens here. And the Japanese soldier who pretended to surrender throws a grenade. Desmond saves Captain Glover and others by deflecting the enemy grenades. And again, this is kind of a too Hollywood thing. The grenade is flying and Desmond jumps up and kicks it like it's a soccer ball.
Yeah, that was ridiculous. Yeah. I was like, that's too.
In real life, I read he just stepped on it. But yeah, you just want to say, go.
No,
please.
Get me out of the film, too.
Come on, Mel. Come on. You're better than that. But anyway, So Desmond is wounded by the grenade that he kicks away in the movie, but the battle is won and the ridge is taken. His men are carrying Desmond toward the cliff's edge, and he cries out for his Bible. He says, "I got to have my Bible." And they say, "Well, you know, we can get you another one when we get back to the hospital." He's like, "No, no, I need my Bible." He wanted, because that was the one that his wife had given him, had her photo in it. One man goes back and they really do find it. That actually did happen. That is a true story. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because Gibson actually had to kind of tone down some of Desmond's heroics. They interviewed him and he said, "I had to take a few things that he did out because I didn't want this to be seen as just completely ridiculously unbelievable."
Yeah, but then he throws in a kicking the grenade.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, I
can't argue with you on that, Sean. Yeah, that was cheesy. But, well, we'll give him a mulligan on that. Or maybe we'll see when we get to the rating part. But like, for example, one thing that happened that they don't show in the movie is Desmond, as he was being carried on a stretcher in real life, he looked over and he saw another man wounded more than him, and he crawled off of the stretcher and said, "Take the stretcher over and carry that man instead." Did you know that, Sean?
Nope, I did not.
That is true. Desmond gave up his stretcher for another man who was more seriously wounded. They eventually did get him down, but they show him being lowered down the cliff, and he's clutching the Bible that Dorothy gave him. This is a beautiful scene. You look up and you see the sun shining, and here comes Desmond descending. It almost kind of brings to mind lowering Jesus down from the cross in a way. You know, it's kind of, I don't know. I think there's a connection there, but I think Gibson is definitely trying to say that Desmond is a Christ-like figure.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't had that happen for a while. We had Thin Red Line. Who was it? Private Wit. Jim Caviezel's character was kind of a Christ-like character.
And then he played Jesus.
Yeah, appropriately enough. Yeah, he decided to go all the way with that. Anyway, the overall Japanese commander is shown, and this kind of, in a way, doesn't fit, but it's kind of, I think, Gibson's way of closing out the battle. They show General Ushijima committing ritual suicide. And that's actually true. He committed seppuku or harikari. I don't know if I pronounced that second one right, but anyway,
it is the correct term.
Yeah. Seppuku. And I've seen the other two in Japanese sources, but anyway, and his, one of his aides actually beheaded him. So
yeah, the way I've always heard it is that seppuku is a formal way of saying it in the proper way. And harikari is more of a vulgar way of saying it.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah. Seppuku is more specific to a samurai's actions and the steps and the ritual that is taking place to regain honor through suicide. Whereas harikari refers to emotion, like the slicing of. Yeah. So,
well, that's interesting. I didn't know. I was
very much into the samurai culture when I was in junior high, when I was a kid. So.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that's good to know. And again, that really did happen. And that was Ushijima's way of, I guess, ending his life with honor in his culture, because he'd lost the battle. He couldn't go home to the emperor.
It was generally expected that a commander would kill themselves, sacrifice their own life because they'd failed to fulfill their duty. The interesting thing was that Okinawa, while it was an extraordinarily bloody battle and many hundreds of thousands, many tens of thousands of American and allied and Japanese troops and Okinawan civilians were killed, it was one of the very first battles where a significant number of Japanese surrendered. Japanese troops surrendered.
Yes.
Although many of them were Korean and Okinawan conscripts. But still, it was the sign that for the first time they were, rather than going on a bonsai charge, they had plenty of them. But rather than everyone finishing their battle out with a bonsai charge, some of them were just straight up surrendering. So
right. Well, then the film switches to archival photos and footage showing that Desmond Doss was awarded the Medal of Honor by President Harry Truman for rescuing 75 soldiers at Hacksaw Ridge. And nobody knows the exact number. I read recently that Doss himself thought it was about 50, but some other people in his unit swore that it was more like 100. So they settled they averaged it out. We'll go with 75. And he was the only conscientious objector to be awarded the Medal of Honor. Doss stayed married to Dorothy until her death in 1991, and that was a tragic story. They were in a car wreck. Desmond was driving, and they were going somewhere, and they got, I don't know the exact details, but it was a car accident, and she was killed, and he remarried later.
He suffered from tremendous health issues for his entire life.
Right. Yeah. He went deaf at one point because of an overdose of antibiotics to cure something else. And he had to have a cochlear implant.
He had had he contracted tuberculosis on Lady Island. He lost one of his lungs and five ribs, and the antibiotic, frequent infections. And so that was what the antibiotics came from. He was unable to use his arm very well, so he wasn't able to work. So he lived on disability pretty much his whole life after, 1950 or so. So
Ended up running a small family farm, but you said, constant health issues the rest of his life.
Yep.
And at the end of the very end, they show the real Desmond Doss, and they show his brother Hal and Captain Glover, all of whom fortunately lived to ripe old ages. And so they were able to give a lot of interviews. And then finally, Desmond died on March 23rd, 2006, at the age of 87. And I just tell you, folks, this is another great American hero. I encourage you, definitely, if you haven't seen this movie, watch it. But also do some research on the real Desmond Doss. Read his story, just like we showed on Alvin York and so many others, Audie Murphy. An amazing story, an amazing man, somebody who stayed true to his faith. He wouldn't compromise on his beliefs, but at the same time, he was determined to serve his country and to serve his fellow soldiers.
I kind of take a little issue with calling him the only conscientious objector to be awarded the Medal of Honor because Alvin York was a conscientious objector, and he tried not to go into the army and ended up losing that fight. Whereas Desmond Doss did join the army. So he was a conscientious objector in terms of being a combat soldier.
Yeah.
Whereas Alvin was a conscientious objector towards being a soldier who ended up becoming a soldier. So
technically, if you're really a conscientious objector,
you don't serve at all.
You don't even go into the army. Like
you don't serve at all. That is a true. That is a conscientious objector.
So he was technically neither one of them was, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I was just quoting from the final title card.
Yeah, I think it's a pat way of saying things, but I don't think it's that's the way he's described, and actually, it's not even true. He was the only conscientious objector to be awarded during World War II. Obviously, Alvin York was a conscientious objector in World War I. Thomas Bennett was a U.S. Army medic killed in action during the Vietnam War, and he was awarded the Medal of Honor, and he was also a conscientious objector who tried to not be, he opposed killing, and he opted to enlist as a conscientious, so he enlisted as a conscientious objector who was willing to serve and was made a field medic. So I guess there's an official classification. Classification is different. A conscientious objector is willing to assist in the military versus one who's not. And so, yes, so he is the first, or he's one of the first conscientious objectors to win the Medal of Honor. Joseph G. LaPointe also was a combat medic during Vietnam who was killed in action and received the Medal of Honor. So to say he's the only one is not true. To say he's the first one is kind of true because he's a conscientious objector willing to assist. Whereas Alvin York was not allowed to be a conscientious objector because of his religious beliefs were personal, not organized in the way that Seventh-day Adventists were.
So assuming I quoted this correctly, I think whoever put that down was overstating the case.
Yes.
Shall we say?
Yes, that's true.
I might have misquoted it. Maybe it said
in World War II. No, it said that. It definitely says that. I remember it saying that in the end title. So yeah, it's overstating something.
All right,
we give you real history here, folks.
That's right.
We are conscious objectors.
To be fair to Gibson and the other filmmakers for this film, when you decide to make a film about actual historic people, you're really putting your neck out on the chopping block in a way, don't you think, Sean? It's pretty brave, I think, to try to tell the story of real people, because you're always going to have to make some artistic license decisions, and you're going to have to change a few things for pacing and things like that. And whereas if you have another movie where everybody's fictional, we've looked at all kinds of movies. We've looked at ones where everybody was fictional. We've looked at movies where everybody was an actual person. We've looked at movies where some were real and some aren't. Most of the people in this are real. Like Smitty is a kind of a composite character. He wasn't a real person, but I think you have to I don't know, maybe you disagree, but maybe cut them a little slack when they're actually trying to portray real people, because I think it is much more challenging. What do you think?
I do, but I'm also of the opinion that history does not need to be embellished.
True. I mean, his story was fascinating enough.
Especially when you're talking about Medal of Honor winners. They received the Medal of Honor winners, the Medal of Honor, for a specific reason. I mean, it is the people who, especially enlisted men and junior officers, who were awarded the Medal of Honor. Now, senior officers were awarded the Medal of Honor for a lot of reasons that not necessarily were their reasons, right? So I'll give you an example. There was a submarine captain, a commander, who was awarded the Medal of Honor for valor in late in the war. And while he deserved it, he also had a crew of men. It wasn't him in a solo submarine, you know, sinking ships in the Japanese inner harbor, inner waters, right? It was a whole crew of men. But when Audie Murphy, you don't need to embellish what Audie Murphy did. If you sit down and read what Audie Murphy did, the movie To Hell and Back was very accurate, because it accurately depicted he stood on a burning tank with a machine gun and held off an entire battalion of German troops. I mean, you don't need to embellish that, because that really happened. So that's my point, is that you do. I think you do need, there's some slack that you can give them, but you don't need to oversell things. He was a conscientious objector who was awarded the Medal of Honor for saving 75 men. He chose to save lives rather than take lives. Like, that's the lead. And to give him an extra plaudit of, well, he was the only conscientious objector to ever be awarded the Medal of Honor, A, it is insulting to Alvin York. It's definitely insulting to the two young men who were killed in Vietnam, who were also conscientious objectors. It's selling your movie, and I get it. But at the same time, like, this is, you know, there were also chaplains who are technically conscientious objectors. They will not fight. But there was a chaplain at D-Day in Normandy who jumped in with the 101st Airborne and was literally, as Germans were shooting at them, was doing last rites on, he was a Catholic priest. He was doing last rites for men in battle right there. So, you know, and he was awarded the Medal of Honor. So I think you don't need to oversell these people. And to say someone's the only one of someone to win the medal, to be awarded the Medal of Honor, you dadgum sure better be sure that that's the right statement. Because if you're not, there's a lot of Medal of Honor winners, awardees, and they don't win the Medal of Honor. They're awarded the Medal of Honor, and they're held in high esteem by the military, extraordinarily high esteem by the military. And you better make sure you're accurate on that. And so that's why I do take objection to this statement.
That makes sense. And I mean, that would be so easy to research. I mean, this is 2015 when this is being filmed. They could have just Googled it.
Right, exactly.
But all right, well, okay. I never thought about it that way, but that's a good point. All right, so we've already talked quite a bit about the cast, Sean. But do you have any final thoughts just on the cast in general or anything else before we move to the rating?
Yeah, no. Andrew Garfield looks just like Desmond Doss.
Very similar. Very similar. Yes.
Yeah. Except the mustache. He doesn't have a mustache.
Yeah, I've seen photos of Doss with and without it. I think he kind of they came and went.
But they do a good job with casting, because John Garfield is a very old actor. Andrew Garfield was he's a tall, thin, handsome guy, right? He's very tall and slim, and Desmond Doss is very tall and slim. So I think if you'd made this movie if you made this movie right in 1945, you could have cast Jimmy Stewart. He would have been too old because he was already in his 30s. But yeah, I think Andrew Garfield's really, really well cast. I don't think Vince Vaughn is well cast at all. I like Vince Vaughn, but I don't think he's well cast.
Yeah. He doesn't work here. No. It just didn't work. You already talked. Hugo Weaving was terrific.
Yeah.
His wife, Rachel Griffiths, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was terrific. I thought Smitty was good. Luke Bracey. Really, I mean, really everybody with the exception of poor old Vince Vaughn.
I mean, okay, I'll take Vince Vaughn, though, over the sergeant from Windtalkers.
Nicolas Cage?
No, the Swedish guy.
Oh, the Peter Stormare.
I love Peter, and I love Peter Stormare as an actor, but not as a Marine Corps gunnery sergeant.
Yeah.
Doesn't
work. The Swede or the Viking.
Doesn't work.
All right. Here now we come to the part that you've all been waiting for. We've gone extra long on this one. There was so much to discuss. It's such a fascinating story and such a epic movie. Thank you for your patience, listener. Now we're finally going to rate the film from 1 to 5 stars. I can't wait to see what Sean is going to say. I'm kind of nervous, but Sean, what are you going to say?
I'm going to give it 3.25.
Oh, man.
I think Andrew Garfield was great.
Oh.
I think there was a little too much Hollywood in some of the sequences. So,
oh, man.
And Vince Vaughn just doesn't work for me at all.
You are tough, my friend. I feel like I'm a
tough critic.
I took a punch in the gut just now, man. Oh, I've taken punches in the gut, but that hurt worse. Okay, well, I love this movie, and I think, Sean, you're going to disagree, but I know there's some Hollywood. There's Vince Vaughn. And for that, I'm going to deduct a half star, but I'm giving it 4.5 because
I love it.
I love I love how they showed how he met his wife and how he got interested in being a medic. I love the boot camp scene. I literally laugh out loud every time I see that. And I just love it. So anyway, 4.5 from me. Surprise. My rating is higher than Sean's.
I'm sure you're going to break my heart in the next two films. So
I'm pretty sure I will on one of them. I'm still thinking about the other. I know you know which one, but we're not going to.
I mean, I've already got my ratings on both of those.
Yeah, so. We don't. Well, let's just cut to the chase and skip the movie. I'm kidding. We're not going to do that. All right. So we're moving on to we've done 14 movies, but we're still not done. We've got at least 3 more planned. Who knows what'll happen after that, but we're definitely doing 3. In our next 2 film reviews, we are going to talk about Prisoners of War. We're going to look at a couple of movies about Prisoners of War. There are many Prisoner of War, just Pacific Theater alone. There's several good movies about the experience of Americans and British and Australian prisoners of war. We thought about doing many of them, and then we decided to cut down to what are probably the 2 best. So next time, we're going to be going back in time again. We haven't done an old movie in a while. We're going to be looking at the 1957 classic epic movie, which I think may have won an award or two, Sean. I'm not too sure about that. The Bridge on the River Kwai. So yes. Join us next time as we talk about that epic movie. We'll see you then. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Key Battles of American History is a proud member of the Parthenon Podcast Network, which includes several other podcasts, including History Unplugged by Scott Rank, Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy by Steve Guerra, This American President by Richard Lim, and Eyewitness History by Josh Cohen. If you haven't already, I strongly encourage you to check out these great podcasts. If you would like to support this podcast and help it to grow, there are 4 things you can do. First, you can subscribe to the podcast and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people to find the podcast. Ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts are especially helpful. Second, join our Facebook group, American History Fanatics, where we discuss the episodes of this podcast, as well as other topics related to American history. Third, tell as many friends as you can about the show. And fourth, you can join the elite unit called Early's Raiders by going to patreon.com and searching for Key Battles of American History. There are 5 different levels of support to choose from. Each level allows you to have early access to ad-free episodes. Higher levels bring additional benefits, including bonus episodes and even the ability to commission episodes on topics of your choosing. Before I close, I would like to give a shout out to the current members of Early's Raiders. Thanks to Majors Chris C., Brandon Cuckler, Mike Leslie, Bob McCullough, Melissa Mueller, Doug Pergram, and Jacob Thomason. Captains Ryan Apashian, Blue Ridge 201, Alex Calabres, Anna Concepcion Castro, Alex Coombs, Jacob Dyke, Grant Holmstrom, Jeff Henley, Stephen James, Jose Martinez, Tim Moon, Michael Rollison, David Santee, Michael Severino, Josh Wheatley, and Gregory Works. And lieutenants Patrick Brennan, Sean Burrell, Matthew Christensen, Ronald Cohen, Craig Didier, Scott Hendricks, Hoosier Daddy, David Lueza, and Jeff Sabo. I greatly appreciate your support.
Thank you for listening to Key Battles of American History. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast catcher. And please be sure and spread the word about the show. If you can spare a few minutes, rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts. This greatly helps us to reach more listeners. And for show notes, maps, and further discussion, visit our website at www.keybattlesofamericanhistory.com. Thank you, and we look forward to joining you again in the next episode of Key Battles of American History.